Welcome to the Legal Nurse Podcast, where you'll get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside the legal nurse consulting business. They'll share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with over 30 years' experience. So join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's your host, Pat Iyer.
This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and today I have with me Dr. James O'Donnell. Jim and I were just tracing back our relationship before we started this podcast, and I know that I must have met Jim in 1990 or so, possibly 1994, when we met at an attorney conference, and he introduced me to Lawyers and Judges Publishing Company. And before I knew it, I was the editor of a book on nursing malpractice. Jim is an associate professor of pharmacology at the Rush Medical College in Chicago. Jim is a diplomat of the American Board of Clinical Pharmacology and a fellow in the American College of Clinical Pharmacology. Jim has been an editor of Drug Injury Book. I think I've known you, Jim, since the first edition. He's now the co-editor of the fourth edition, and he's also the founding editor of the Journal of Pharmacy Practice. He consults and testifies. I know my company has used him as an expert witness. He estimates he's testified in more than 400 trials. His experience is in malpractice cases and also criminal cases. And he has a lot of experience in pharmacy error cases. He's written extensively on that topic. We've decided today to focus on the allegations against pharmacists and just pick out of Jim's vast experience a subset of his areas of expertise. Well, welcome to the show, Jim. I'm so glad that you could be with us today.
Well, thank you, Pat, and it was nice to get a brief history of how we came up in this type of practice.
I know that you've gotten quite a bit of experience looking at cases as an expert witness. What are some of the most common allegations against pharmacists?
Well, 75% are either the wrong drug, which represents 50%, or the wrong strength of the drug. So Inderal is prescribed and Lasix is given, or Inderal is prescribed as a 10 milligrams and instead 40 milligrams is administered. The remaining 25% includes primarily the wrong directions. So someone's told to take one tablet every 2 hours instead of every 12 hours. I've seen that error because somebody covered up the one of the 12 with an auxiliary label. And the other area that pretty much fills out the rest of the pie is the drug review and counseling. And by drug review, there's a standard and a law of the OBRA that requires that pharmacists perform a drug utilization review for safe dose, lack of interactions, lack of allergies, and then counseling is explaining to the patient how the drug should be used and what is important that they should be concerned about and what side effects they can dismiss. These two areas, that of the drug review and counseling allegations, are the largest area of growth in the past 20 years. Clearly they are standard of practice, and more and more companies have policies and procedures that require this, and While it's not as large an issue as the wrong drug and the wrong strength, it is an important area of the pharmacist's responsibilities for providing more than the correct drug to the patient, but rather making sure that there's no problems with other drugs and making sure that the patient understands how to use them.
And I would assume if a person's getting all of her prescriptions filled by one pharmacy chain, for example, let's just pick CVS as an example. The CVS computers are all connected to each other, so they would show if she went into one CVS in one city and went into a different CVS in a different city or even within the same city. But what if she has prescriptions filled at Rite Aid and CVS and Eckert and a number of chains? How does that pharmacist do the drug review if the prescriptions are spread out between competing companies?
They should ask the patient, are you taking any medications that you're filling elsewhere? What other medications are you taking? Are you taking any over-the-counter medications? Are you taking any dietary supplements? And on repeat, after there's a relationship established with that pharmacist, then each time they see the patient, they say, is there anything new that you're taking that you weren't taking the last time we filled your prescription? And while there is an assumed reliance on integration of all the CVS profiles into one for the patient, they may not appear on the same page. The pharmacist may need to go to a different screen to see what else is there. So even under those circumstances, it's always best for the pharmacist just to ask the question, besides, do you have any allergies? What other medications are you taking? And that will provide the adequate and necessary information for the pharmacist to perform the drug utilization review, and it also sets the basis for counseling.
Interesting. I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that you said earlier between wrong drug, filling a prescription with the wrong drug, which you've shared with me is 50% of the pharmacy errors, and wrong strength is 27%. Combined, they equal more than 75%. When we focus on the wrong drug, I'd really like us to think about what happens in a typical community pharmacy. Somebody walks in with a prescription. Who fills that prescription?
Well, typically it's received by a pharmacy technician who, in most states, is licensed by the state through a board of pharmacy. And that person has to make sure that the information on the prescription is complete. They get additional information such as date of birth and address and phone number, and then verify if they're in the computer or not. That is then usually scanned and put into a pharmacy queue, if you will, and the scanned prescription is visible. Part of that scanning process, that technician types in, gets the patient information in there, enters, selects a drug from a drop-down menu based on the medical listing of drugs, enters the directions for use, and then what happens then is that on a command, a filling document is generated by the pharmacy printer. That technician or another selects the medication from the pharmacy inventory, counts or pours out the prescribed quantity, puts the medication in a prescription vial or bottle, and a 6 is the label. At this point, or even before, a pharmacist looks at that screen and verifies that the information is adequate, that a DUR is performed, a review for allergy, cross-sensitivities, a review of any drug interaction warnings or high-dose warnings or low-dose warnings. After that verification is done, and indeed that step is sometimes done off-site in a different pharmacy, which makes things a little bit more complicated, but once the prescription medication is put in the prescription bottle and a label is attached, then a pharmacist has to do a final check. The pharmacist should unscrew or unlatch the cap on the prescription vial, view the medication in the bottle. The computer screen that was generated with a image of the prescription also provides an image of the dosage form, the tablets, the blue tablets, the marking, and some may indeed have a image of the manufacturer's container. So it provides the pharmacist with a visualization of what the medication should look like. So when they're looking at the prescription in the bottle that's prepared for the patient, they have a secondary visual source. Many pharmacists can keep what we call the stock container as part of that final check by the pharmacist. Some companies remove the stock container and the pharmacist is verifying or checking the prescription based only on the image on the screen. Almost universally, the pharmacist is the only person who bags and seals the prescription label. As some safety factors that are built into the filling process, most systems now have barcode readers where the technician, when they're selecting a drug, will do a barcode on the manufacturer's container, and that should match what the barcode that's generated by the system in the entered prescription. So that's a safety factor. For those without that level of technology, there is another safety factor of reviewing a unique national drug code number that's on every prescription container and writing that number down on the front or back of the prescription document. So it is an additional way of verifying that the drug that's ordered in the computer is indeed the drug that's selected. And I've actually worked with both systems, and they both work, though the barcode is certainly one that is becoming universal in hospitals now, so any nurses would be familiar with that, but it's becoming very common in dispensing pharmacies as well. Once the prescription is checked and closed and stapled, and the sheets, the patient information sheets and receipts are printed up, those are usually now added, put in the bag because of HIPAA, and then depending on whether the patient is waiting for the prescription, then the pharmacist should take the prescription to the patient and counsel the patient. If the patient's not waiting, then it's put in a final prescription storage area for pickup by the patient or a family member when they the next time they're in the store. So that's the process. The hands-on, there are two definite processes for the pharmacist involved that are very, very heavy reliance on pharmacy technicians to do what we call the non-judgmental work, rather the clerical work and inventory handling and selection. So that's the process, and it's pretty universal since we've had computers, and of course I started working in drugstores when we only had typewriters.
Before I continue with the show, I want to share information about a resource I have for you that gives vital information about medical errors. I have a one-hour audio training called Killer Cure. Listen in as I interview Elizabeth Bewley. She's a safety expert. She exposes the sources of errors in the healthcare system. Healthcare kills more than 600,000 people every year. That's the equivalent of the population of Boston. Elizabeth defines our hidden assumptions about healthcare, medications, and treatments, and why those assumptions put you in danger. She is president and CEO of the Perio Health Institute and the author of Killer Cure, Why Healthcare is the Second Leading Cause of Death in America, and How to Ensure That It's Not Yours. She was an executive with Johnson & Johnson for 20 years and became interested in patient safety after she had personal experiences with healthcare that almost led to her death. Order this audio training at http://lnc.tips/killercure. And Killer Cure is one word. That address is http://lnc.tips/killercure. Use the coupon code LISTENED to get a 25% discount on the price. Do you still get involved in cases where there's handwritten prescriptions?
Oh, yes. Right now, that's the e-prescriptions represents, I think the latest figure I've seen is 50%. So there are still handwritten prescriptions. And then a lot of prescriptions continue to be faxed. So that's what I described was the written prescription, but the process is the same, with the exception of an e-prescription is in the computer and the technician works from that as a source document. A fax prescription is handled just like a handwritten prescription. And indeed, we still get calls from doctor's offices where they dictate a prescription over the telephone, just as they would in a hospital where they're giving a verbal order to a nurse. But we're getting more and more electronic and technical, and the number of written prescriptions is and predictably will shrink as there's wider utilization of the e-prescribing.
You're describing a system that sounds like there are many steps involved, and I'm impressed with the fact that the pharmacist has a computer screen to be able to look at to say, this Coumadin 5 milligrams pill should look like this image on the screen. And yet, you've shared with us that 50% of the pharmacy errors are involved in the wrong drug being handed to the patient. So where does the system break down?
Well, the technician may select the wrong drug from the selection of the drop-down menu when they're looking it up. The technician may select the wrong drug, take it off the shelf, and they're not using a barcode system. So those are two ways that happens. The same thing with the wrong strength. We're still relying on people, and people sometimes make mistakes or don't follow policies that are in place to enhance safety and detect errors before they're dispensed to the patient.
I've been standing in a pharmacy area of a store, and I've seen people driving up to the window. I've seen somebody answering the phone and taking information on the phone. I've seen lines of people waiting at the cash register to pay for prescriptions or drop off prescriptions or pick them up. And how do all of those simultaneous demands factor into these types of errors?
Well, it's certainly challenging. There are many, many distractions. The pharmacist needs to grow blinders and try to stay focused on one prescription at a time, which is difficult with telephone calls, questions, and the process of filling the prescription. And with a large, high-volume store, in my opinion, the risk for errors increases. I was once interviewed for CNN on the issue of pharmacy errors, and they asked me the question is, what do we tell the public about, avoiding or how to avoid prescription errors? And I said, well, I describe a picture of, like you did, of 10 women, because there could be some men there too, clasping onto their day timers, a little bit dated, now their cell phones and their purses, glaring at the pharmacist. And I wanted to say, as a pharmacist, I want to say to you, which of you wants the mistake?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we can't be rushed. And there is some type of urgency that is expected by the public. It's expected by management. Some pharmacists seem to have that urgency. I remember the first day I worked in a chain store on a Saturday morning, and it was busy, and the prescriptions started backing up, and my technician said, we need to move faster. I said, well, it's going as fast as it goes. And she said, well, we need to get these prescriptions out in 20 minutes. I said, well, that's not going to happen. He says, well, then I have to tell the manager that we need cash certificates to give patients who wait more than 20 minutes. And I said, well, you better tell the manager to get a bunch of them. And by the way, have you ever heard of Domino's Pizzas with promising an on-time delivery that ended up in a $100 million punitive damage lawsuit? You cannot rush certain things. And if there's a great volume and not adequate time to work, then it's going to create a perfect storm for an error or a mistake or an oversight. Indeed, one of the issues that I hear about from pharmacists and this is discussed in some of the pharmacy literature is a metric evaluation of when the prescription hits the window and when it is finished on the other end of the pharmacy. In other words, the time it takes to fill the prescription and check it. And if a pharmacist is on duty and they don't make that metric, they take longer than the average, then their manager talks to them about moving faster, filling faster. And I say that is a prescription for disaster. It's definitely a prescription for disaster.
So. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about some of the drugs that are commonly involved in errors? Are there certain ones that are more deadly or more prevalent than others?
Yes, they are. And, you know, the usual, I call them the usual suspects. And it's a factor of two things. There's, well, we know which ones are commonly involved in claims, and indeed the data that I provided to you is claims experienced by the Pharmacist Mutual Insurance Company. And so there are other drugs that are involved in errors, but they only result in claims because if you're taking a Cipro pill and you get 500 milligrams instead of 250 or vice versa, it's not likely that you're going to be injured.
Mm-hmm.
But so the ones, the drugs that we see in claims are both high volume drugs that they have the potential for injury, or the lack of, they're high volume drugs that if you give them the, you're not giving the correct drug to the patient, or you're giving the wrong strength, say too low a dose, then the patient has a significant adverse event. So what I've listed for my usual suspects are anticoagulants. You give too much and people bleed. When people bleed, there could be a brain bleed, could be a GI bleed, or it could be a nosebleed. If someone needs an anticoagulant and they get the wrong drug or they get too low a dose, they stroke or they have a heart attack. So, I mean, these are, you know, high alert sentinel drugs that are narrow therapeutic index, meaning that the intended effect is within a certain window. Another class that's commonly involved, of course, are insulin and oral hypoglycemics.
Mm-hmm.
Insulin, you give too much, patients get hypoglycemic and seize and have brain damage. Same thing with oral hypoglycemics like glipizide. Synthroids are common. Synthroid has about 12 different dosage forms and all very, very small, minute fraction of milligrams. Penicillins, allergic reactions, especially cross-allergy among the penicillins, the synthetic penicillins like amoxicillin, the cephalosporins, the old Keflex, which is still used. And that's one reason why it's so extremely important that every time every patient sees a pharmacist, that pharmacist should be asking the question, what drugs are you allergic to? Opiates, we see if the patient gets too much, an opiate can cause respiratory depression, or even the point of not asking the question of, you know, I've seen emergency room prescriptions for given with fentanyl patches or OxyContin pills to patients who are opiate naive. Opiate naivety or lack of tolerance is a contraindication. And so a pharmacist getting a prescription for a chronic high-dose opiate should see evidence of opiate use that would justify a high-dose opiate. Of course, beta blockers and ACE inhibitors are high-volume fast movers, as they're called, and too high a dose or too low a dose, you get too much effect. Someone's blood pressure drops, they faint, they hit their head, and the damage is hitting the head. The drug doesn't cause any organic damage. You see a lot of amitriptyline errors. Amitriptyline, a tricyclic antidepressant, was used for 30 years as the primary antidepressant, and that use was replaced by the Prozac and a long line of SSRIs like Zoloft, Paxil, but it's used commonly both in pediatrics for enuresis, low dose, and in geriatrics, low dose, to help people sleep because it causes drowsiness. But a common error with amitriptyline is 10 milligrams is prescribed and 100 milligrams is dispensed. When they do that, they're not considering the dose. They're asleep at the switch. Now, it may be written wrong by the doctor, or maybe entered wrong, selected wrong by the technician, but the pharmacist is not thinking, why is my 80-year-old lady who's on digoxin and cartizem and coumadin getting 100 milligrams of amitriptyline? Prednisone and corticosteroids, we see dosage errors commonly where 50 milligram tablets are dispensed in place of 5. Patients get psychotic, and if they're on it long enough, they develop osteoporosis and fractured hips. And then Lipitor and statins, primarily because of the volume, it's almost a rite of passage. Once you pass the age of 40 or 50, everybody gets put on Lipitor or some other statin. So those are the usual suspects. And of course, then there are other drugs that pop up. Just about every drug that's prescribed could result in a claim. I'm giving a lecture next week to the a reproductive immunology group on some forensic drug matters in obstetrics and gynecology. And I was reflecting on the fact that we have a significant amount of advanced immunotherapy, chemotherapy, but from my viewpoint as an expert who reviews drug injury cases, we don't see reports of errors with the high-priced, highly technical drugs. We see the reports of errors and injuries with these drugs that have been around even longer than I have, just because our systems are not adequate and more to blame, or our people are not doing the job right, or they have too much work to do and they can't do it safely.
Well, Jim, you've listed drugs that probably many of our listeners are on, and it certainly is sobering. I appreciate you sharing your expertise. How can our listeners learn more about what you offer?
Well, I do have a web page. I'm in practice with my partner, who is also my son. It's pharmaconsultantinc.com, or easier to spell, jamestodonnell.com. And we also have on the website our curriculum, a list of the types of cases that we consult in, and reference to the books that we have published, especially the latest O'Donnell drug injury book. And in fact, we will have two new books coming out in the next 3 years that we're working on now. Our telephone number and emails are listed on that jamestodonnell.com website.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I appreciate your attention, your expertise. You've made me think about some aspects of getting prescriptions filled that I took for granted. And if any of our listeners are saved from a medication error because they recognize they've been given the wrong drug, we will have a side benefit from our time together today.
Well, let me make one final comment and recommendation. What happened, even though pharmacists by law and by policy are supposed to counsel patients, what I see happen too often is the technician brings the prescription out and says, do you have any questions for the pharmacist? Which, if you do, that prompts a counseling. My answer to them is, well, I don't know what this is, so how can I have any questions? So, since I don't know what it is, my recommendation to every patient is said, yes, of course I do. I want the patient, I want the pharmacist to talk to me about this drug. Michael Cohen, who has published the Medication Errors books and is president and founder of the Institute for Safe Medication Practices, has written that 95% of errors can be caught in this counseling process. And if you don't do the counseling, you're missing an opportunity for error. For example, you have this drug here is for your stomach. And the patient said, what do you mean stomach? I went there because I was depressed. Well, they were dispensing Prilosec instead of Prozac.
Mm.
So don't say, don't take that. So answer the question, yes, I want to talk to the pharmacist. And thanks again for the opportunity, Kat.
All right, Jim. Thank you. And for our listeners, please be sure to listen next week when we have a new interview. Give us a review on iTunes. That would be great. And sign up to receive the transcripts so that you can go back and refer to this information. Jim has given me a couple of slides that I'm going to include in the transcript that will give you some key concepts that you can refer to. And thanks for being a part of our show.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount on this product. You'll put that code LISTENED in the coupon code box during checkout.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes. We always are interested in your ideas for new topics. Please leave a comment on legalnursepodcasts.com. Join our community and get notified of each new episode and receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on legalnursepodcasts.com. We appreciate you and your interest.